This is KUT Weekend for the second weekend of February 2017. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. Reports of federal immigration authorities conducting raids on undocumented immigrants in Austin.
These are, I believe, retaliatory actions.
The Texas Senate adopts a bill that could jail sheriffs who don't cooperate fully with federal immigration officials.
The sheriffs of the 254 counties potentially then become criminals.
And how young black men are mentoring middle school students in East Austin.
So when you make the A's and B's, you gotta show me your report card.
Yes, sir.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. But first, a reminder that you can subscribe to this podcast if you want to at weekend.kut.org. We have links to iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, RSS feeds there. If you can, leave us a review in the Apple Podcasts app or the iTunes Store. It does help us out a lot. And if you have any questions, shoot me an email, nathan@kut.org, or you can ask me on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. Congressman Joaquin Castro, a Democrat from San Antonio, says he has been informed by Immigration and Customs Enforcement about raids taking place in Texas. He issued this statement this afternoon, it's Friday as I record this, that he has been informed by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that the agency's San Antonio field office has launched a targeted operation in South and Central Texas as part of Operation Crosscheck. Castro says he's asking ICE to clarify whether these individuals are in fact dangerous, violent threats to our communities and not people who are here peacefully raising families and contributing to our state. He says he will continue to monitor the information. Now, Austin City Councilmember Greg Cassar believes this recent ICE activity in Austin amounts to political retaliation. He appeared today with Councilmember Delia Garza and immigrant advocates at a news conference in response to these recent reports of detentions. The Travis County Sheriff, of course, enacted last week a policy of limited cooperation with federal requests for extended detention of suspected immigrants. And Cassar says he's confirmed that there have been what he calls ICE actions in immigrant neighborhoods.
These are, I believe, retaliatory actions meant to punish our community for standing up against Abbott and Trump and the politics of fear and hate in Texas. We won't stand for federal enforcement actions that are meant to be political retaliation against our community.
A freshman Republican Texas senator whose district stretches from Abilene to Austin, Don Buckingham, calls it outrageous that Austin City Council members are publicly denouncing law enforcement activity. Buckingham says it puts the community at risk. Meanwhile, Eddie Rodriguez, a Democrat representing Austin in the Texas House, tweeted today that children are afraid to go to school or leave their homes. He said, quote, "This is what a police state looks like." Meanwhile, the Austin Independent School District superintendent sent out a letter today saying the school district is committed to the emotional well-being of students. And that letter listed some of the resources that the district offers, including the Refugee Support Office and the International Welcome Center. Education Austin, a local teachers union, has been putting together materials for teachers to share with their students and families. And those materials include a handout from the National Immigrant Law Center that reminds immigrants about their rights. Now, earlier this morning, an ICE agent pulled over a vehicle and reported that he was facing resistance, including concern about a subject possibly trying to get the agent's weapon. So Austin police responded to that. They arrived to find one man in custody. Two women with the man were found to have outstanding arrest warrants for misdemeanors. They were arrested by Austin police. APD Interim Chief Brian Manley says he knows the talk about incidents such as this are creating fear among immigrants, but he says immigrants have nothing to fear from the Austin Police Department.
If you're in Austin and you're committing crime, then yes, you need to worry about the Austin Police Department coming after you. If you are in Austin and you are not committing crime, then that is not a concern you need to have.
This is obviously still a developing story, so we'll have more for you at KUT.org and on our station, KUT 90.5. Let's turn now to a state bill that would punish so-called sanctuary cities. It's one step closer to becoming Texas law after action by the state Senate this week. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey tells us that senators made one notable change to the bill before they passed it.
That change made good on Governor Greg Abbott's promise. Lawmakers amended Senate Bill 4 to make it a criminal offense to defy it. That creates a route to remove an office holder. Under the bill, for example, Travis County Sheriff Sally Hernandez could be charged with a misdemeanor and removed from elected office. Senator Charles Uresti appeared to have trouble believing the move.
Okay, so our sheriff, then, the sheriffs of the 254 counties would potentially then become criminals?
The answer is yes. Beyond that change, the bulk of Senate Bill 4 remains the same. It would hold back state grants from local law enforcement agencies that have a policy limiting cooperation with the federal immigration agency, known as ICE. Senator Charles Perry authored the bill. He says it'll ensure a consistent application of federal immigration law across local jurisdictions.
I think consistent and uniformity breeds integrity. And I think anytime you can enhance integrity in our process, then the public good is served.
The bill also prohibits any local law enforcement from adopting a policy that restricts officers from asking about immigration status when someone has been stopped or arrested. Several senators noted the palpable fear in the voices of those who testified at the public hearing on the bill last week, fear of deportation. But Perry emphasized the portion of his bill that protects witnesses or victims of crimes from being asked about immigration status. Instead of being afraid, he said, immigrant communities should feel safe with Senate Bill 4.
We want your involvement. We want your input if you're in a crime, if you're in a bad situation. If you see something in your communities, you now have statutory protection.
The governor has made banning so-called sanctuary cities an emergency item, meaning lawmakers could pass it into law more quickly than rules allow. Audrey McGlinchey, KUT News.
So by the way, that bill passed out of the Senate on Wednesday. It's now waiting to be taken up by a House committee. Will it stand a chance in the Texas House? I asked Mark Jones, political scientist at Rice University, who's been following the state legislature closely for years.
Well, sanctuary cities has arrived in the House. It will be sent to Byron Cook's State Affairs Committee. I would expect it to pass out of State Affairs and reach the House floor. The real question is to what extent it might be amended to soften its blow on counties like Travis County, Dallas County, or cities like the city of Houston if Mayor Sylvester Turner wants to move forward and making it more of a sanctuary city.
Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner doesn't seem too concerned about that, as Al Ortiz reports.
Mayor Turner says the city of Houston isn't breaking any laws. Turner has always refused to call Houston a sanctuary city. He says he's not concerned about the Houston Police Department's policy of not asking about immigration status.
I see no reason for the city of Houston to be losing any sort of dollars on a state or federal level, as long as we are operating in accordance to the United States Supreme Court.
Turner's argument is that the court's rulings prevent law enforcement agencies from profiling based on whether somebody might be in the country without the appropriate immigration documents. However, Turner wouldn't comment on potential repercussions for Houston if Harris County Sheriff Ed Gonzalez eliminates the 287G program. That program allows sheriff deputies to turn in undocumented immigrants to federal authorities.
Al Ortiz with Houston Public Radio Station, KUHF. Democratic State Representative Donna Dukes of Austin is not showing up to the Capitol a lot these days, at least according to House records. But Dukes says those records are wrong. And as KUT's Ashley Lopez reports, Dukes says a House custom is to blame.
Here's the breakdown. Out of 14 legislative days so far, Donna Dukes has been marked present just 5 times. And according to records, none of those absences were excused. I asked UT Law Professor Hugh Brady to walk me through the rules about all this. He says if you're a House member and you're going to be absent or late, you typically ask your deskmate to file a motion for your absence.
So when the House comes in, they'll take the initial registration to determine that there's a quorum.
The House will come to order. Members, please register.
You have to have a quorum before you can conduct business. Then they'll hear prayer from the chaplain, and then they hear excuses for absent members, and you'll hear the speaker say,
excuse Representative Stuckey to attend a funeral, and motion Representative Lambert, excuse Representative Wilson.
And the person is excused for the rest of the day. That doesn't mean they can't come in if they're, you know, for whatever reason, but they do have an excuse for that day.
Dukes has an explanation for her absences.
Absolutely, I've been there. The journal is not always correct.
Dukes explains that typically during that initial registration, you know, when you heard this sound, other legislators register folks in as a courtesy, even if they aren't at their seat at that moment.
Apparently, there's a new one or two that don't know the process.
And by the way, what Dukes is talking about is completely within the rules. And she's right that it could make the recorded roll call a tad unreliable in that way. But there are other things to consider. For example, on the days that Dukes was marked absent and there was a vote on something, she was also marked absent on that vote. And a couple of times, Dukes was the only person that was marked absent without an excuse. So when people didn't follow custom, she was the only person it affected. That being said, there are folks on social media raising questions about her absences. But Dukes says it's all political.
And it's a very infantile, juvenile game that the so-called people are playing to constantly try and create rules and things that are different for me because they're targeting me.
Dukes is under indictment for misusing public funds. She had promised to resign her seat when she sought re-election last year, but she changed her mind at the last minute. That's why even though the House can't do much for the first 60 days of the session, her attendance is getting some scrutiny. And Hugh Brady says there's one last reason folks should ask questions about a House member's attendance. It's because the state constitution says regardless of whether they are present, they each get a base salary of $600 a month and $190 for each legislative day. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
Have you ever looked up at the construction cranes around town and wondered why it takes so long for things to get built in Austin? Developers will say the city's permitting process has a lot to do with it. Well, now the city is about to start a new program, hopefully to speed that permitting process up. But with speed comes a new set of rules. KUT's Saida Hassan has that.
The city's new expedited permit program could help speed up the notoriously slow and convoluted building review process. It'll allow developers to pay a premium in exchange for a faster review, but they'll have to follow certain regulations. After a vote by city council last week, large-scale commercial developers who use the program will have to ensure certain protections for construction workers. Bo Delp is with the Workers' Defense Project. His group advocated for those protections.
The idea here is to create a baseline for what's expected from project owners as they go through the expedited permit review process. Austin is growing. That is a fact. We want to make sure that it grows responsibly in a way that works for everybody and that creates good and safe jobs in the process.
The protections are based on standards set by the Better Builder Program, which is run by the Workers' Defense Project. Among the requirements are providing workers' compensation, safety training, and paying a so-called living wage. For large-scale commercial projects, these requirements must all be verified by an independent on-site monitor. But there's another stipulation that makes some in the builder community hesitant. They must recruit 30% of their workforce hours from Department of Labor registered apprenticeships. Some stakeholders have criticized that clause, saying it gives unfair preference to union training programs versus those offered at local schools or colleges. But Bo Delp says you don't have to be in a union to establish one of these training programs.
Here in Central Texas, it just also happens that many of them are labor unions, but there's nothing stopping from a non-union shop from setting up their own DOL registered apprenticeship program. For us, it's about the quality of the training.
Austin Community College runs some of those non-union training programs. In an emailed statement, a spokesperson for ACC said, quote, "The college remains hopeful that the city policy will offer flexibility for recruiting, including from ACC's training programs. For example, ACC offers electrician training courses for about $2,500. Michael Murphy is with the Austin chapter of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. His union's electrician training program runs about $740.
It requires 10,000 hours on the job in addition to 960 classroom hours, and those on the job hours are paid hours.
City staff are still working to fine-tune the guidelines, but the program is expected to go into effect this spring. Saida Hassan, KUT News.
Republican lawmakers in Washington are quickly rolling back Obama-era regulations. One environmental rule potentially in their sights was enacted after the devastating fertilizer plant explosion in the Texas town of West that happened in 2013. As KUT's Moes Bouchel reports, some people in Texas think the new rule should not only stay on the books, but should be strengthened.
In response to the explosion in West, the EPA beefed up requirements on how businesses store and handle some dangerous chemicals. The rules were released in the waning days of the Obama administration, says Tom McGarity, a professor of environmental law at UT Austin.
So the idea was to prevent releases of really highly toxic materials from facilities that contain them, and explosions within those facilities from highly reactive materials.
The new requirements strengthen risk management plans the facilities are supposed to have, require third-party auditors review safety if something goes wrong, and
another very important aspect of the rule was greatly enhancing the protections for first responders.
12 of the 15 people killed in the West explosion were first responders. That's one of the reasons McGarity is worried about a resolution introduced in the House of Representatives this month to roll back the safety rules. The resolution was filed under the Congressional Review Act, which allows lawmakers to quickly block regulations within 60 legislative days of their taking effect.
Well, I don't know what is in that regulation.
I called the mayor of West, Tommy Mushka, to get his opinion on the effort to roll back chemical safety rules.
But sometimes regulations are needed when companies that make dangerous stuff fail to regulate themselves. People's lives are then in danger.
But there's a wrinkle to this story. The chemical that caused the West explosion, often used in fertilizers, was ammonium nitrate. But the EPA didn't include ammonium nitrate on its list of chemicals to come under the stricter regulation. That also bothers the mayor.
Yes, I'm not aware of what's in that regulation, but I do know that ammonium nitrate is what blew up this town, and somebody needs to be looking into that.
The EPA says it will consider including ammonium nitrate in the new regulations at a later date. That is if the regulations survive at all. Moz Bouchel, KET News.
Keeling Middle School has a long history in the East Austin neighborhood around 12th and Chacon Streets. It was named after an African-American teacher. The school served black students until it was closed under desegregation. Then it was reopened in the mid-1980s. Today, nearly a quarter of students are considered at risk of dropping out. That's why the PTA runs a mentorship program specifically for male students called Keeling Men. So for our On My Block series, KUT's Kate McGee spent time with a student and his mentor.
It's in between classes at Keeling, and the hallways are full of students. It's quieter in the library. That's where Gabriel Russell and Josh Morgan are chatting.
How was your, did you take a test last week?
Yeah.
How was it? What test was it?
It was actually four consecutive tests.
Okay.
Which
one was the hardest?
The math.
Gabriel and Josh go to school less than a mile from each other. Josh is in eighth grade at Keeling, and Gabriel is a junior at Houston-Tillotson University, the historically black university in East Austin. They met through the school's Keeling Men program. It pairs young male students with male mentors.
One day we were talking about the shootings of black males, and we were getting into deep thought about it. And
Joshua says his summer track coach was shot by a police officer.
I was kind of put into an emotional state.
The principal at Keeling recommended Josh enter the mentorship program. That's where he met Gabriel. Gabriel is studying education at Houston-Tillotson and wants to become a school superintendent.
I played sports in high school, so I wanted to go to school for something with students, with kids, being around, you know, active. I want to always help somebody.
Gabriel and Josh have similar backgrounds. They both grew up without fathers at home, but growing up in a single-parent household hasn't stopped them from being successful. Joshua is a rising track star. He made it to the Junior Olympics last summer. And he does well in school, despite problems during elementary school when he was diagnosed with ADHD. It took a while to get that diagnosis. He often had outbursts in class and was labeled a problem child by his teachers. It also made him conscious of being a young black man.
With most of the other kids, whenever they had outbursts, they'd handle them a bit longer or try to calm them down. But with me, they'd just send me straight to the place that they send the kids who had the outburst. And majority of those other kids were Caucasians, and so I kind of felt like it wasn't very fair.
His mentor, Gabriel, grew up in Fort Worth. Gabriel had his own struggles. He was homeless for a few months as a teenager, living in his car with his mom and siblings when money got tight. He went to Houston Tillotson on a full academic scholarship. He's a National Honor Society student. Gabriel's also a well-known face on HT's campus. He's the campus king.
Mr. Houston Tillotson is a Mr. and Miss Houston Tillotson University. We kind of like the faces of the student body. So let's say the president has to go speak somewhere and the student, you know, you want student body to be there. Anytime anybody's on campus, we introduce ourselves as Mr. Houston Tillotson, Miss and Mr. Houston Tillotson. Welcome you to our campus.
Students compete in a pageant for the titles. They perform a talent or platform. Gabriel focuses on education. He does a spoken word performance that talks about how to inspire other young men of color.
Born to a single mother, homeless at the age of 14, by society standards, I shouldn't be here. But today, I'm the first in my family to attend and soon graduate from university.
At Houston Tillotson last week, Gabriel practiced his performance for friends and staff.
I am desired to call my people from the seduction of mediocrity and inadequacy to a future miraculously clear.
He was heading to St. Louis to compete against other black male college students from historically black colleges and universities for the title Mr. HBCU. Spoken word and writing are another thing Gabriel and Josh have in common. Gabriel's life experience without a male role model at home is a big part of his work. Same with Josh.
I am in control of my future, the next fastest man alive, a better man than my father, a man that keeps his word, a person who doesn't give up.
At home in his room, Josh reads one of his poems.
Just the writing alone, I mean, any form of writing I really honestly like. I mean, it makes me feel like when I write, it's kind of makes me feel like I can do whatever I like with the writing. Do it in my own time, my own way. Don't have to do it this specific way. I don't have to do this specific thing in order to do this. And it's kind of a place where I feel peaceful, I guess you could say.
The person I wish to be, creative, nerdy, the thing that connects my family's differences, the thing that will take away my mother's pain.
When Josh and Gabriel meet, they usually just talk. Sometimes Gabriel brings pizza. When you look at the narrative about young men of color in the United States, there's this perception that they are all in crisis. Looking at Gabriel and Josh, it's clear it's not always that way. That's one way the mentorship program aims to help these middle school students.
Those are 9.5?
Yeah.
They fit?
Somewhat.
Back in the library, Gabriel and Josh are chatting about shoes. Gabriel works at a Foot Locker, and he says if Josh does well on his report card, there could be a new pair of shoes in his future.
Today, she's trying to make sure you won't grow out of them too fast.
I won't, yeah, she's trying to make sure I won't grow out of them too fast.
But those are 9.5,
mm-hmm.
And they fit all right?
Yeah.
Okay. So when you make the A's and B's, you got to show me your report card.
Yes, sir.
And then I'll take you.
Afterwards, Gabriel heads back to campus, and Josh heads back to class. With a little more motivation to study hard. Kate McGee, KUT News.
So my favorite radio station in Austin after KUT and KUTX, of course, is KAZI 88.7 FM. It's a community radio station. It was founded in 1982 by John Warfield, who's a former director of the Center for African and African American Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. And his goal was to provide a broadcast voice to the underserved African American population in Austin. KAZI still serves that community, but it has a diverse listenership. A lot of people probably listen to it for the same reasons I do. They play R&B, hip-hop, soul, disco music. It's not all just what's charting right now like you hear on some of the commercial stations. They'll go back 10, 20 years, 30 years. And they have a lot of talk shows, too, and sometimes they broadcast Austin City Council proceedings. So anyway, last week, KAZI went off the air for more than 3 days. And that was because they had problems with their STL, their studio to transmitter link. That's the wireless connection that sends audio from the actual studio to the transmitter, which is then broadcast from the radio tower. They've also been dealing with transmitter problems as well. Steve Savage is the general manager of KZI. Steve, thanks for talking to us.
You're welcome. Thanks for reaching out.
Can you tell me a little bit about the transmitter troubles you've had lately?
Over the last 6 months, we've been having transmitter problems. If you listen to KZI, probably for 5 or 10 minutes at the hour, the KZI just goes down. It just stopped working. So that's because our transmitters need to be replaced. We only operate at probably about between 75 and 88% of what the transmitter can put out. So we had started the GoFundMe page at the end of December, but we never did post it. We had like two postings to it. So on Wednesday evening, when we went off the air, we know it was very crucial because we was off the air from Wednesday up until Saturday at 2:45. So we had a couple things going on. Our STL went down. We didn't know at the time what was going on. So the motherboard went down on STL, which is the power supply. So we had to order a new power supply, and we got that back up by us posting about our problems we had. So we had a couple organizations committed to give us the money for the transmitter. One organization I would name, I hope I got the name right, but it's part of Apple. I'm not at work, so I don't have it with me right now. But
okay.
It's the nonprofit portion of Apple, which they gave us $3,000 towards the transmitter. It's about the local people that doesn't want to be named at this time, but we'll probably name them later on, maybe in the next week or so, if they give us permission to.
And is it still cutting out in and out from time to time?
Yes, it is. But at least we're on the air. I would say periodically, maybe 2 or 3 times a day. It says we go down for like 5 or 10 minutes. You might be listening to the radio, all of a sudden you don't hear nothing, then they would come back on. That's part of our STL and transmitter problem. We would like to be in a situation that we could have a backup for both a backup transmitter and a backup STL.
You really provide a service to everyone in Austin, but in particular the African American community here. Can you talk to me a little bit about that, Steve?
Yes, we do. You know, our goal is, you know, we are a community radio station. We are we have an educational license, and with our license too, we're supposed to educate the public on different things. You know, we have 26 talk shows, including Democracy Now! And Black America, Health Talk, various shows, Economic Perspective. So we have 26 total. But also what we do, in the past, you know, KAZI was the only station at the time was where only play, I call it the sounds of blackness, all black forms of music, jazz, blues, reggae, R&B, gospel, rap, zydeco. We was the only station that plays that at one particular time. So that's one way that we actually help the community. But for KAZI, our listenership is so diverse. You know, we've been here, this is our 35th year. Our listenership is so diverse. It wasn't for a diversity of our listenership, KAZI wouldn't be around.
Right. So you're representing in many ways the sounds of Black Austin, as you said, but it's not just Black people who are listening to the station.
That's correct. Everybody listening to KAZI, because you know, we give tickets away to different events and we have all different nationalities come over and win tickets and stuff. So yes, we are definitely the community station.
Steve Savage is general manager of KAZI 88.7 FM. They have enough money to build a new transmitter, but they're still trying to raise money for a studio-to-transmitter like an STL. Steve, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, Nick. I really appreciate that.
A lot of new restaurants catering to trend-seeking foodies who are looking for something cutting-edge or unique. But one new steakhouse in downtown Austin is not going down that path. They just want to offer a contemporary take on some classic food in a lively atmosphere. And joining us to give us his review of the place is Austin American Statesman restaurant critic Matthew Odom. Hi, Matthew.
Hey there, Nathan.
What is the name of this restaurant?
The name of the restaurant is Red Ash. Got to be careful. Red Ash. And the name comes from the ash that comes from the wood-burning grill at this restaurant, which is down at 3rd and Colorado Streets.
Can you tell me who's behind it?
So I think Austinites will be familiar with some of these names, or at least their restaurants. So Larry Foles and Guy Villavasso, along with executive chef John Carter, are all the partners there. And Foles and Villavasso started Z Tejas, they started Eddie V's, they started Hop Dottie. So they have a long string of success. Carver was actually over at Eddie V's with them. So what this is kind of a different take on a steakhouse. It's got an Italian theme. Mostly that's through the pastas that are on the menu. But it kind of takes the steakhouse of the 90s and modernizes it. It's in this industrial space. It's kind of a little corny. It's got some graffiti on the walls, and it's supposed to be hip and edgy, and it kind of ends up feeling more like something called the Austin Grill that you could find in like Scottsdale or Florida or something. So it doesn't have a unique Austin-ness about it. But besides that, it's not trying to be more than it is, which is really just kind of a chop house and a pasta place.
Tell me about what's on the menu. What do they got?
So they've got some of the best meatballs I've had in town. I think that's veal and boar and beef. And those were nice, juicy, small plates. They have a snapper crudo that was nice and had that kind of anise taste of fennel to it. There was octopus a la plancha. And I think it was sous vide first and then finished on the plancha. And they've got a porterhouse on the menu and a bone-in double-cut filet. Kind of what they hang their hat on, in addition to the pastas, are these huge steaks, these hand-cut, dry-aged steaks that they have that are $2.50 an ounce is how they sell them. So that doesn't mean you can order a 2-ounce steak, but
right.
That means they hand-cut them.
So a 1-pound steak would be, what, like $40?
Right, and there weren't any of those when I was there. There was a 30-ounce filet, I believe. There was a 50-ounce ribeye, which ended up running me about $125.
You eat that all yourself?
I did not.
You had some help?
We had some help, and we took it home. They carve it for you, so when they bring it to you, it's in these big, meaty dominoes that are falling off the bone. It was probably undercooked by just a few seconds, but it was a nice piece of meat. It had a great char on the outside. And then the pasta dishes are as robust and as intense as everything else on the menu. They have pappardelle that they make in-house with wild boar bolognese, which is really rich. They have potato gnocchi that came in this gorgonzola cream with big wavy folds of speck throughout it. So that was nice and rich. Cappelletti pastas that are filled with spinach and ricotta and served in brown butter and sage with some walnuts, nice winter flavors there. So very filling, very...
comforting, sounds like.
Very comforting. It really is kind of a boutique take on a pasta and steakhouse.
I imagine the prices are on the higher side.
Right, you could get out of there for less than $100 a person, but we didn't either time. I would be careful. The pastas come in small and large. If you order one of those big steaks, you're not going to need too much more, of course. But you could get a small plate and a pasta and get out of there for about $70 a person after a glass of wine. But you're looking at least a couple $100 for two if you're doing it right.
You kind of described the interior already, but I'm just curious what the vibe is like at Red Ash.
You know, it's fun. They have an open kitchen, so that provides some energy. They have an elevated dining room, which is it's a kind of a different thing. They've got a big bar scene that looks like it's probably popular at happy hour. I did see several attorneys I know from downtown having dinner in there each night. A little more mature crowd. It is loud, so people should know that. But it's not people with their phones out taking Instagram photos of tweezered food. You know, it's more robust than that. It's more comforting than that, as you mentioned. And it's kind of a restaurant for people who like to eat out, but there's not a lot of restaurants being opened for folks like that around town these days. So it does fill a unique niche, I guess.
The restaurant is Red Ash. It's on 3rd and Colorado. And you can read Matthew Odom's full review right now at Austin360.com or in Friday's print edition of the Austin American Statesman. Matthew, great to see you.
Always a pleasure, Nathan.
For the second weekend of February 2017. Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. And if you have any questions or comments, email me, Nathan at kut.org. Our theme music is by RAC. Thanks again for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org.
And then,